has allied itself with. Some of them don't even produce a light bulb, like Saudi Arabia. How important is the fact that you have a country like Iran resist and win over the U.S. and its pursuit offensively in the military arena when it stands on its feet, producing its own military equipment and then asserting itself that way? Less than a minute, please.
Well, look, as I said earlier, sanctions have been a miracle for Iran. And similarly, the defense industry has been able to progress in the manner that it has is because the sanctions were applied so aggressively. If they were not, then Iran would have been importing all kinds of armaments from neighboring countries or from Russia or from China or from wherever it was possible. But because of the sanctions, they had to develop their own industry. And due to that, it has become certainly a number one military power in West Asia, without any doubt. And for that particular reason, all this sort of nuclear issue just a bogus. It really is that they want to emasculate Iran by not allowing it to produce its own armament industry.
Thank you very much, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst from London. And thank you, Zakir Ahmed Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikaba Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 2-4 of Surah Nahl, recited by Murtaza Rahnema.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Yunazzilul malaa'ikata bir-ruhi min amrihi 'ala man yasha'u min 'ibadihi an أنذروا أنه لا إله إلا أنا فاتقون. خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق تعالى عما يشركون خلق الإنسان من فإذا هو خصيم مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate, He sends down the angels with inspiration by His commandment, on whom He pleases of His servants, saying, "Give the warning that there is no God but Me. Therefore, be careful of your duty to Me." He created the heavens and the earth with the truth. Highly exalted be He above what they associate with Him. He created man from a small seed, and lo, he is an open contender.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines, a UN spokesperson says delivering aid to quake-hit regions in northern Syria has been hampered by a terrorist group there. A Palestinian child succumbs to injuries that he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. And the U.S. military shoots down another unidentified flying object. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizem Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. The quake hit areas in Turkey and Syria. The death toll keeps rising. Over 33,000 people have so far been confirmed dead in the two countries. Officials say some 29,600 people have been killed in Turkey. At least thousands of hundreds have also lost their lives in the powerful earthquake. Rescue workers continue to scour neighborhoods despite the freezing weather. Experts, however, are cautioning that hopes of finding people alive are getting very slim. And the United States, the United Nations, that is, and the terrorist group in control of part of the quake-hit northern Syria are hampering the transfer of aid to the Syrian government. A spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office says deliveries are held up over the approval issue of the terrorist group known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Terrorists come as concerns are growing over the situation in the 3 days. The powerful earthquakes rocked the astonishingly the region in Turkey and Syria, and deaths from the injuries have been reported in the territory of the Persian group. Meanwhile, Martin Griffiths learned that the United Nations is not spending separately on aid missions to the quake-hit areas and in Syria. Griffiths also painted a grim picture of the situation there, Syria and Turkey, saying that the death toll is expected to double the amount. Moving on, yet another act of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. The regime troops have shot dead a 14-year-old boy in the occupied West Bank. He was killed as Israeli troops conducted a raid on the flashpoint city of Jenin. Two other Palestinians were injured and are in the affection. Israeli forces regularly carry out deadly raids in the West Bank under the pretext of detaining Palestinians. The latest fatality comes as Palestinians were holding a funeral for a killed by the Israeli settler in the West Bank. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians, killing nearly 50 people in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year. The U.S. military has shot down an unidentified flying object, this time over the Lake of Huron in the state of Michigan. This is the third object intercepted in the U.S. skies in the recent 3 days. The Pentagon spokesperson said the object, traveling at an altitude of 20,000 feet, was caught, shot down by fighter jets upon a presidential order. Patrick Reuter says the object might have had surveillance activities as it was detected near sensitive military sites, but posed no threat to them. The Canadian team has begun searching for the wreckage of the object that was shot down on Saturday. American authorities have not specified the details of the three objects on the radar. Recently, the U.S. also shot down what it called a Chinese spy balloon that had entered the American airspace. Beijing slammed the move as an unconstructive one, saying that the balloon was a civilian meteorological airship that had been blown off course. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, says he intends to return home from the United States. The far-right politician faces accusations of inciting riots in the country following his defeat in the presidential election. We discuss this with our guests in our studio. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who is facing accusations of inciting riots in his country, says that he is going to go back home soon from his retreat in the U.S., the far-right politician saying that he'll be back in Brazil in the coming weeks. Bolsonaro left Brazil several days before his supporters stormed government buildings in the capital of Brasilia, while they tried to overturn the election victory of his rival, Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro is under investigation in Brazil over his alleged role in the January 8th assault. He denies any responsibility, but Lula accuses him of orchestrating what he calls the coup. Washington has also been under pressure to extradite Bolsonaro. The riots in Brasilia have been compared to the 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former American President Donald Trump. Time now to discuss this a little bit, so let me invite Camila Escalante, our correspondent, now in La Paz. Also with me is Isaac Biggio, Latin American expert, who is in London. Good to see you both. Let's go to Camila. First, tell us in the first place why Bolsonaro did not concede defeat in the election. Tell us why in the first place he left for the U.S. Why is he going back? He's facing charges back at home.
Absolutely. Well, he left in the final days of 2022 at the end of December, and it was on legal counsel that he decided. He was advised that he could be instantly arrested and jailed once the new government took power on January 1st. He didn't want to be part of the formal handing over of power to Lula, nor was his vice president a part of that. So he took off in those final days. He's been in Florida since. He arrived with a 30-day diplomatic visa, and we've heard a couple of things since then. On the one hand, You know, he's been doing these speaking events in Florida since he's been there. And we've heard from people around him that he is still looking for a way to actually stay in the United States and extend his visa. At the same time, he's made the comment at some of his speaking events, including yesterday, that he will be looking to return to Brazil because his mission is not completed. That's what he said. And that he has, you know, he's hinted or suggested that he has a movement to lead, a right-wing movement to lead, because there's no leadership on the national level, although there is sort of subnational and regional leadership of, you know, these sort of pro-Bolsonaro political sectors. So it's unclear whether he will be able to successfully stay in the United States or if he really is coming or returning to Brazil. But it's important to note that in his final months as president in Brazil, he was kind of missing in action. He wasn't actually seen speaking to his base, holding public rallies, but he has this sort of audience that has been very receptive of him in the United States. So he kind of failed to lead his movement there, although it seems like he's very popular abroad right now. So, you know, it's very unclear what's going to happen, but it is the case that if he returns to Brazil, he will remain more politically relevant than if he's going to remain on the exterior, and that he does have a significant base that continues to support him. All of those millions of people who voted for him in the election that don't have a leadership or direction. So I think he's aware of that. And he also sees that there's no other or very few options for him on the exterior if he's going to try to, for example, seek asylum and run away from the potential charges that he'll be facing back in Brazil.
Okay. Isaac Bijou, how do you look at this? I mean, will he be in a better situation if he goes back to Brazil? And what do you expect President Lula to do in the judicial system in Brazil?
Well, I think at the moment Bolsonaro is playing, because sometimes he said that he's coming soon, sometimes his son or his lawyer said he applied for a six-month visa. So he's looking what's the best outcome for him. Uh-huh. I agree with the other panelists, because he's more popular now in the States than in Brazil, because he's linked with Trump. If Trump passes, he's going to go for a trial. But on the other hand, I don't think the USA is going to give him asylum, because Joe Biden faced a similar coup two generations before than the coup that Bolsonaro did in Brazil. So my impression is that Bolsonaro will continue playing around while he's seeing what's the best situation for him. On the other hand, uh-huh, I don't believe that Joe Biden is going to be happy having Bolsonaro in the States, because he wants to be close with Lula. Albeit he can use Bolsonaro's situation to press Lula to be more pragmatic, more pro-USA, and more distant from the radical left in Latin America.
Okay. And Isaac, what do you see on the horizon as regards the U.S.-Brazil relationship now that President Lula is back in office?
Well, Lula is not a president that fight against the United States. It's not like Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, or Cuba. Mm-hmm. But he had some difference with the United States. For example, Brazil is more multipolar. He's more trying to make bridges with Russia, with India, with China. And Brazil is going to relaunch the Community of States of Latin America and the Caribbean, which has all, which united 33 countries out of the states, the South American Union of Nations, UNASUR, which is 12 countries, 12 republics in South America. And he's trying to create like a multipolar agenda. He had contradiction with the states regarding to Russia and Ukraine. Uh-huh. Albeit he criticized Russia for entering Ukraine, he's against arming Ukraine. So he's going to play a different role in international politics, and perhaps Biden is going to use Bolsonaro in the states to pressurize Lula to be more moderate or less radical, no? Already, Lula, for example, in the case of Peru, is the only Latin American progressive president that he's not condemning the coup d'etat in Peru, like, for example, Colombia. He's openly saying that the Peruvian police is acting like Nazis. He's trying to be conciliatory with the Peruvian coup, which is linked to the United States. So I think that Brazil is going to have a very moderate agenda, distant from the USA, but not radically in opposition to the United States.
Okay, we'll wait and see. Thank you so much for your contribution, Camila Escalante, our correspondent in La Paz, Isaac Bijou, Latin America expert in London.
Protests have been held across Italy against the national broadcaster's decision to read a message by the Ukrainian president during the country's biggest entertainment show of the year. Protesters have said the government must stop using public TV channels to promote aggressive rhetoric. Max Civilli reports.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
Noi oggi siamo.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kyiv is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kyiv with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kyiv is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civilli, Rome.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Thank you. When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In spite of the current emergency situation in quake-stricken Syria and the very dire need to lift the Western sanctions, it is unlikely that the West will change its crippling anti-Syria policies to allow Syrians to merely survive. The economic stranglehold and selective approach to aid Syria will lead to more death and displacement. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. RT wrote in an op-ed, following the devastating earthquakes that rocked Turkey, Syria, and their neighboring countries on February 6th, leaving more than 20,000 dead, Damascus is struggling to deal with this unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe as it remains under brutal Western sanctions. The West war on Syria that began in early 2011 failed to topple its elected president. But the subsequent years of increasingly cruel sanctions, all in the name of helping the Syrian people, have led to rendering life miserable, with most unable to afford to properly feed their families, much less heat their homes. Now, in a time of crisis, the Syrian people cannot even receive donations or emergency support from abroad. One supporter set up a GoFundMe campaign only to have it taken down due to the sanctions. Type the word Ukraine into the search field on PayPal or GoFundMe and you will see countless appeals for sending money to Ukraine. But for Syrians, Western platforms like these are off limits and have been for years. On February 6th, southern Turkey and northern Syria were hit by a 7.8 magnitude earthquake, followed by dozens of aftershocks, and then another earthquake. While the neighboring countries of Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, Iraq, and others were affected, the worst of the damage was in Turkey and Syria. As of February 9th, the official death toll in Syria was 1,347 with more than 2,300 injured. Nearly 300,000 Syrians have been displaced due to the earthquakes. The scenes initially coming out of Turkey and Syria were heartbreaking and catastrophic, with buildings collapsing in front of people and piles of rubble with the dead and the maimed trapped below. In Syria, the earthquakes added to already extensive damage from the war. Aleppo, the country's second largest city, was tragically prone to building collapses because of the occupation that had lasted until 2016. With the Syrian population already struggling to just survive prior to the earthquakes, now Aleppo and the coastal regions of Syria affected by the earthquakes face even more death, injury, and displacement. Even without the earthquake, Syrians struggled to get medication. Hospitals struggled to get or maintain critical machinery and equipment, and the population as a whole suffocated as the country's economy steadily worsened, all by design. Here's what life is like for many Syrians now, according to British journalist Vanessa Bealey. The U.S. and its proxy separatist forces are occupying Syrian resources in the northeast, which includes their oil. At the moment, we have basically about 2 or 3 hours of electricity per day. There is no heating in the majority of homes across Syria. As Bealey notes, earthquake displaced Syrians, unless they receive emergency aid, face freezing and wet conditions without any alternative shelter, without any electricity, without any heating. And thanks to the sanctions, desperately needed humanitarian aid and fundraising is difficult. International cargo planes can't land in Syria, and crowdfunding services and even credit cards are unavailable. The virtue signaling Western nations, the main cause of suffering in Syria since 2011, have not only persisted in keeping the sanctions in place, most of them haven't offered any meaningful help since the earthquake, just hollow words. The Chinese Foreign Ministry blamed the sanctions for amplifying the miserable situation and likewise pointed out that the U.S. illegal presence in Syria and theft of Syrian resources was also exacerbating the economic situation. Frequent U.S. military strikes and harsh economic sanctions have caused huge civilian casualties and taken away the means to subsistence of the Syrians. As we speak, the U.S. troops continue to occupy Syria's principal oil-producing regions. They have plundered more than 80% of Syria's oil production and smuggled and burned Syria's grain stock. All this has made Syria's humanitarian crisis even worse. All of the above has left Syrians to rely mostly on the country's friends for help. Incidentally, many of those nations and groups are among the most vilified by the West. Following the earthquake, the Islamic Republic of Iran sent a plane with tons of medical food and sanitary aid to Syria and has pledged to send more. Also, Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance movement, sent convoys of humanitarian aid to Syria. Lebanon's army said it would send members of its engineering regiments to Syria to contribute to the search and rescue operations. Also, Russia's Ministry of Defense dispatched over 300 personnel and 60 military and special vehicles for rescue and aid efforts in Syria. The Russian Emergencies Ministry sent more than 100 rescue workers to Turkey and Syria, including an air mobile hospital with 40 medics. Even battered Libya, itself largely destroyed by another Western regime change project, sent a plane with 40 tons of medical and humanitarian aid as well as an ambulance to Aleppo Industrial Airport. Recently, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned about a looming secondary disaster in Syria, pointing to major disruptions to basic life supplies, but failing to highlight the role of Western sanctions. Such reports likewise neglected to mention the need for emergency relief in government-controlled areas of Syria and the government's efforts to bring that relief in. Some 12 years into the West proxy war on Syria, the continued denial of the very basics of emergency humanitarian relief to Syrians outside the rebel-controlled areas shows how little the West claim to care for Syrians really matter. The lack of concern by the UN, WHO, and affiliated aid agencies for the Syrians of Aleppo, among other government-controlled areas, is not at all surprising, given these bodies over the years systematically downplayed terrorism against Syrian civilians. In a statement recently, the Middle East Council of Churches call for the immediate lifting of sanctions on Syria and allowing access to all materials, so sanctions may not turn into a crime against humanity. The Associated Press reported that, in theory, aid operations in government areas should not be blocked by sanctions since both the U.S. and EU have exemptions for humanitarian aid. The outlet noted, but the reality on the ground is sometimes different. Banks might block transfers to pay suppliers or local workers for aid organizations for fear of running afoul of sanctions, despite the exemptions. Also, U.S. sanctions and, to some extent, EU ones try to prevent rebuilding of damaged infrastructure and property in government-held areas in the absence of a political solution, which could hamper post-earthquake recovery. Abed Ayyub, director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, wrote on Twitter that we welcome the decision by the U.S. Department of Treasury to issue a broad general license on Syria sanctions. This will ease sanctions and allow for much-needed additional aid to the country, Ayyub said.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. It's a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues that have affected Pakistan recently. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, and we shall also look at the deadly attack in Peshawar, leaving more than 100 dead and scores injured. We will discuss the legacy of Parvez Musharraf, the former president of Pakistan, who died at 79 after spending years in exile.
The deadly Peshawar attack occurred when the mosque was jam-packed with worshippers. Not claiming the responsibility of the attack, the TTP has reiterated that their target are the security forces and they will be carrying out attacks throughout the country. The National Security Commission of Pakistan has reaffirmed its zero-tolerance policy against all terrorist activities, dealing sternly with the banned outfits. The commission statement was, however, followed by a threat by the TTP to the political leaders, including the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister of Pakistan.
Last month, on January 30, more than 100 people were killed and 225 injured when a suicide bomber set off his explosive vest inside a mosque during the rush hour for the prayers. The incident occurred in the police lines of the Peshawar city in Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province bordering Afghanistan. The attack has been regarded as one of the deadliest in the recent past, taking place in the high-security zone that also houses the state's police secretariat.
Technically speaking, Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP, has not walked out of the ceasefire. What has happened is that the current form of TTP which you are looking at is an amalgamation of several different splinter groups from within the TTP itself. So what is happening is that one of those splinter groups, which was any which way very powerful independently when it was outside of this whole conglomeration, that particular group has taken the responsibility of this latest blast and several other attacks which has taken place in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. So what is happening is that this particular group, leadership of this particular group was targeted by Pakistani intelligence agency, and they were killed in Afghanistan and also inside Pakistan. So this group this group is fighting for its survival because its top leadership has been liquidated. So they are basically trying to sort of create a new aura for itself, a shock and awe incident. By these militant groups always create an aura for themselves, and they attract these incidents help them attract newer recruits.
The Tehreek-Taliban Pakistan initially claimed the responsibility for the attack, which was later refuted by the spokesperson of the banned outfit. Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif regarded the bombing as an unimaginable human tragedy, equating it with an attack on the country itself. While visiting the wounded in Peshawar, the Prime Minister said that stern action will be taken against the perpetrators of this crime. Expressing condolences to the families of the victims, he regarded their pain beyond expression. Reiterating that terrorism is the foremost enemy of Pakistan, Shahbaz Sharif said the nation is overwhelmed by a deep sense of grief but determined against the criminals who commit heinous crimes of taking lives.
One cannot discuss the recent surge in violence without discussing the foreign policy or the internal policy, security policy of Imran Khan government. Imran Khan has a very, very simpleton view, simpleton take as far as terrorism is concerned. And he always sees the internal security status as something to do with being pro-West or not being progressed. But this is not true, because even if you put United States and other Western countries out of the equation, these militant organizations, these Deobandi-influenced militant organizations, they are in itself a very problematic and a big security threat for Pakistan. So Imran Khan's insistence that, we should talk with them, and we should rehabilitate them within the Pakistani population, that has been seen as a weakness by TTP. Look, a state can only negotiate with a militant organization with an upper hand. The problem was the Pakistanis does not have an upper hand as of now, and they want to negotiate. When you negotiate with a poorer position, it means that the militant organization will take it as you bowing down to their whim. And this is never good for the security of any country.
Since its inception in 2007, the Tehreek-e-Taliban has been in a state of rebellion with the successive governments of Pakistan. Hit by a recent wave of terrorism, there has been a resurgence in the terrorist attacks, especially in the provinces of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan. In the year 2022 alone, more than 150 attacks were carried out by the outfit, mainly against the defense forces, resulting in more than 150 deaths. The present economic and political turmoil has been regarded as one of the reasons of this resurgence.
Since withdrawing from the ceasefire signed between the government of Pakistan and the TTP, the Tehreek-Taliban Pakistan has been responsible for more than 100 attacks in the last 1 year. The outfit has intensified its attack on the Pakistani army and police since November 2022. There's a looming threat of rise in the violence in the coming months, and according to the security experts, 2023 may prove to be a bloody year. The defense analysts link this terrorism surge to the worst economic crisis and political instability that Pakistan is facing. Issuing warning to the Pakistani armed forces carrying out operations against its fighters in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, the Pakistani Taliban has threatened of targeting the security forces throughout the country.
Such big incidents always galvanize strata of the society. So the people, government, intelligence agencies, army, they all normally come on the same page when such a huge attack takes place. So, but the problem is this coming together on one page that does not survive for a very, very long time, as we saw in the case of APS attack. When the APS attack happened, immediately after that, an operation was launched and the entire area was cleared of Tehrik-e-Taliban. I mean, it was a very, very bloody fight, but the success was achieved. Now, the problem is the last Pakistani COS, his legacy is, sorry to say, very, very poor in all regards, in the way he has interfered in the politics of Pakistan, the way he has squandered whatever achievements which his predecessors had done vis-a-vis TTP in the tribal belts. So now what is happening is that once again, every a part of the country, which means every stakeholder, army, intelligence agencies, people, government, they appear to be on the same page as of now. And this would always mean that there would be an operation to eradicate them.
Pakistan has been battling with terrorist attacks since the past two decades. However, the intensity has increased in the last 3 months, with the Tehrik-Taliban Pakistan breaking the Afghan-Taliban arranged ceasefire accord between the Pakistani government and the Taliban fighters. In one of the deadliest attacks since 2018, on 4th March 2020, the Islamic State Khorasan province attacked in Peshawar in March last year, resulting in the death of 64 people. The latest violence has raised the horror alarm amongst the residents of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, fearing a military operation in the tribal areas.
Militant agencies all over the world, they do give threats. The only difference is in the case of TTP, we must take it very seriously. Because every time they have given a threat, they have managed to sort of create some incident or the other, which is very, very spectacular. Because that is what they want. They want a spectacular incident to happen so that it will sort of boost their image among the population, which is attracted toward this special Deobandi influenced jihad. So what is happening is that to achieve that, they go out of the way. Now, what is problematic is that because of the deeply entrenched Deobandi ideology inside the general population of Pakistan, it is very easy for TTP to find sympathizers from not only within the governments but also within the security agencies and intelligence agencies and army and everybody, because the people of Deobandi ideology make a large portion of population in Pakistan. So the problem is the ease with which they infiltrate the government machinery. This is very, very problematic. So their threat should never be taken as an idle threat. Their threat, most of the time, is followed by a bite. So I guess that this threat would be taken seriously in Islamabad, and I think the security agencies, army, and the civilian government will be on the same page to deal very, very strongly with this organization.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
leaving a controversial legacy behind. Pakistan's former president Parvez Musharraf died at the age of 79. The four-star general who seized power after a 1999 military coup was known as a key US ally against Al-Qaeda in South Asia. The response to his death in Pakistan was muted, with many senior figures refraining from commenting on his complex legacy out of respect. Shahbaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, whose brother Nawaz Sharif was overthrown and imprisoned by Musharraf, tweeted offering condolences to the family of the former general.
Musharraf was born in a lower middle class family in Delhi that moved to Karachi after the partition of 1947. Securing a place in Pakistani army, he quickly rose through the ranks and became Pakistan's top military general, leading a bloodless coup against the Nawaz Sharif's government in 1999. After the 9/11 attacks, Musharraf became known for his close alliance with the U.S. and its war on terror. He was once described by the former U.S. President George W. Bush as a courageous leader and a friend of the United States. His decision to align with the U.S. contradicted Pakistan's long-standing support for the Taliban, who controlled Afghanistan during that period. Proving to be damaging for Pakistan, the decision made Musharraf a target for domestic militant groups. His support to the U.S. invasion proved deeply unpopular, as it led to heavy civilian casualties, resulting in a deep anti-Western sentiment throughout the country. However, it seems that Pakistan had no other choice. In the words of Musharraf, the Bush administration had threatened to bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age had the country not cooperated with America's war on Afghanistan.
For some, the ex-military ruler of Pakistan was an able administrator, a person with a modern outlook who was credited with attracting foreign investment. He garnered the support of the military and Pakistanis who backed his crackdown against the militant groups. While many condoled the demise of the main architect of Kargil War, others questioned his legacy, believing that he failed to build on his early popularity of promoting sustainable economic and political reforms. He turned into a captive of military power and vested interests.
In February 1999, just weeks after the then Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee visited Lahore on the invitation of Sharif to try to make a breakthrough in bilateral relations by signing the Lahore Declaration, Pakistani troops disguised as irregular fighters secretly infiltrated the line of control in the Kargil sector. It triggered a brief but fierce border conflict that ended disastrously for the Pakistani side. While Musharraf claimed that the ceasefire in Kargil was a military triumph, others in Pakistan considered it one of the biggest tragic blunders in Pakistan's history. Kargil War was responsible for the first confrontation of two atomic powers, resulting in the increase in tensions between India and Pakistan. Another consequence of Kargil War was the refusal of the U.S. to reward Pakistan for its aggression. America insisted on Pakistan's withdrawal to the line of control. This led to an immediate and positive impact on the Indo-US relations and changed the geopolitics of the region. Pakistan was heavily criticized by many countries for instigating the war. Even China, a longtime friend of Pakistan, insisted on a pullout of forces along the LOC. On the other hand, India was praised internationally for its restraint, resulting in further weakening the position of Pakistan.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Munir Ahmed from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Mr. Ahmed, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Parvez Musharraf was a general who took power with a coup and was forced into exile later. So the question is, what lesson has his life given to the people and the governments in the region?
Certainly, yes. There are many lessons to learn from General Musharraf's era and from him as well. He was the dictator, as everyone knows, and he toppled the democratic government. First of all, majority of the country did not accept him as a ruler, because everyone in Pakistan, the general public, has been like frustrated about the dictatorship and the military corporates that are run in Pakistan. And the second lessons that is to be learned from. That was this sort of democratic process he launched. Mostly, they were all the third-rate, mostly the third-rate politicians he collected around him, and those who call like always go for vested interest. And they were not the politicians, but the rejected people of in the politics of Pakistan. And then, and what the regime they developed in Pakistan, the I'm talking about the political regime, and that was not acceptable to most of the people. And thirdly, the you know, allegations of corruption against the politicians and arrests on some so-called corruption cases was also not liked by the people, and it was merely called political victimization.
Mr. Ahmed, so for many Pakistanis, Musharraf left behind a grim legacy. Is his legacy still having an impact on the country?
His legacy is no more, I believe. But the elements he promoted in Pakistan still exist. Even when the establishment has to oust the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif from the government, he launched Imran Khan, who was already a power monger and power hungry at that time. And he could not have been getting much popularity in the political arena. So establishment took him as their main horse, and they collected all those rejected pieces again around him. And those promoted one are still in the politics of Pakistan and in the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. And they are around with Imran Khan. So I think they still exist in the politics. But as far as we say, like the legacy of Pervez Musharraf in terms of its own political party, that does not exist. But the elements of his party has joined mostly PTI, or have been silent for some time.
Mr. Ahmed, the Kargil war can be considered as one of the most important events during Musharraf's tenure. What lasting effect did the war have on Pakistan?
Kargil war, I must not say that it as a war, but that misadventure of General Musharraf has so many implications for Pakistan's diplomacy and friendly the efforts to have friendly ties with India. And also, like, it has created chaos among the ranks of the establishment, army, and the politicians. That the misadventure that led to, you know, more bitter relationship with India. And also, Pakistan sacrificed so many lives of the soldiers over there. And still, we feel that we cannot cope up with the damage that Kargil war did to Pakistan, to its society, and its to bilateral relations with India. And we still feel that Pakistan shall have Pakistan and India shall have friendly bilateral ties, so that because half of the families live in India and half of the families live in Pakistan, and they have been living for decades or so, and if there are a certain bitterness between the two countries, the visa regimes are stopped. So no visas for the families to go and come to Pakistan. So, and this is really a tyranny for the families and their relationships.
Before we let you go, sir, some experts believe that instead of supporting the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, Musharraf could have negotiated and drawn a red line to maximize Pakistan's strategic interests. What is your opinion on this?
Pakistan's decision to go to go with America for the war with Afghanistan or in Afghanistan or attacking Afghanistan was certainly could have been negotiated and for more strategic benefits. Whatever we earn of the friendship or the strategic mileage before, in the previous two decades before going to war on terrorism was lost during the war on terrorism. And we also lost more than 80,000 of soldiers and civilians in Pakistan in the Fatah areas and on the borders adjacent to Afghanistan. So that was the major loss. We also had a very collateral damage of billions of rupees in those areas where the Pakistan army was fighting against the terrorists. And the third loss was Pakistan had very bitter relationship with Taliban. Though Taliban was not created by Pakistan, but that was the offshoot of the Mujahideen or the previous war or jihad against the Russian invasion, quote unquote, in Afghanistan. But if there had been a democratic government or the Soviet